Today, reality on the blink again. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly, the 23rd of February 2019, our digest of the latest finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. The gap between the real data on housing and finance and the narrative offered by the RBA continues to widen. Plus, more on banking separation, which is now running on a new set of legs, and the markets are backing the end of the trade wars just as China turns off the tap for some Australian coal exports. But people are claiming it's just a little local difficulty. And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or consider joining our Patreon program. Again, here is the link. We really appreciate your support, which helps us to continue to make great content. The links are also in the comments below. Governor Lowe appeared before the House Standing Committee on Economics, which took place on Friday. The session was streamed in audio only, a poor show that they were unable to arrange a web show, as it's hard to follow who was talking. And they also released a transcript. He said that the RBA's central scenario for this year is for growth of around 3%, inflation of around 2%, and unemployment at around 5%. The economy is benefiting from increased spending on infrastructure and a pickup in private investment as capacity utilization has tightened. And the strong growth in jobs is also supporting spending, as is the sustained low level of interest rates. And looking beyond income growth, developments in the housing market can also affect overall spending in the economy, he said. Lower turnover means less of the spending that occurs when people move homes. Declining housing prices also make some people feel less wealthy, so they spend less, although this effect doesn't look to be particularly large, he said. Lower housing prices are also associated with less construction activity in the economy, so these are the areas that the RBA is keeping a watch on. And this adjustment in the housing market is not expected to derail our economy, he said. It will put our housing markets on more sustainable footings, and it will allow more people to purchase their own home. And there are some wealth effects from declining housing prices, but they're relatively small. He said we've got to remember that in Sydney and Melbourne, prices are still up 70 or 80% over a decade, so most people are sitting on very substantial capital gains. People who purchased in the last 18 months or so are not, but most people are sitting on substantial capital gains, so there are still positive wealth effects coming from that. It's largely the income story, which doesn't get talked about enough, because the media love talking about property prices. But year after year of weak income growth finally weighs on our spending plans, so both the pickup in wages growth and the tax cuts will boost disposable income growth. Now, there were three points to take away from all this. First, the RBA is holding to its view that eventually wages will start to rise. Despite the results reported by the ABS this week, the trend wage price index rose 0.5% in the December quarter and 2.3% across the year, according to figures from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Growth remains anemic. And the trend quarterly rise of 0.5% continues an extended period of moderate hourly wage growth. Annually, private sector wages rose 2.3% and public sector wages grew 2.5%. Second, Lowe played down the home price falls and argued that this has little to do with APRA tightening lending standards, as banks are still lending and offering discounted rates for new loans. Third, the RBA will use monetary policy to trim the economic sails, including expected tax cuts and even a lower US dollar, but accepted that QE could be used in certain scenarios if required. Dr. Lowe said, "I would very much hope that we don't have to go down that route. If the economy were to slow significantly, there are multiple margins of adjustment, things that could be done. We could lower interest rates further, of course. there could be a fiscal stimulus and the exchange rate would adjust. So all these margins of adjustment could take place before we would need to consider this. But in extremis, there are scenarios where that would have to be seriously considered. And by the way, they played down the potential impact on asset prices if QE were activated. So I came away with a view that the RBA's perspective continues to be rosy, perhaps too rosy, and the impact of tighter credit, the easing credit impulse, and lower loan-to-income multiples seem, well, unimportant. Now, I found this predictable, but remember, they have said recently they're not sure what level of debt would be too much, implying we are not there yet. But given the high household debt ratios in Australia, this lack of focus on debt is, I think, disgraceful. And the Bank of England this week, in a blog on the Bank Underground site, said, "What goes up must come down," modelling the mortgage cycle. It is critical for economists and policymakers to understand the drivers of the mortgage credit cycle. On the one hand, it is important for policymakers to know how the housing cycle and mortgage structure affects the transmission of monetary policy. On the other hand, spotting the signs of a potential mortgage market slowdown early might help to avoid some of the detrimental impacts from future events similar to those that took place a decade ago. We agree, and I must question whether the RBA does. And I have to say, I felt the governor had a very easy time in the committee, other than perhaps the QE discussion. The rest was, well, all puff. In contrast, we ran our live show this week, taking questions from our audience of more than 600 real-time viewers. We updated our property scenarios to take account of a range of new data and the latest input from our household surveys. A peak-to-trough home price fall of 20 to 30% over 2 to 3 years remains our base case, but with risks to the downside. On the other hand, the RBA's base case only gets a 1% probability now. The factors we've considered include lower inflation and growth rates ahead, according to the RBA, Fed future rate hikes on hold, potential for more QE in the Eurozone, Japan, and other centres too, recent home price falls in Australia driven by weaker credit impulse, underemployment still a significant issue, and wages flat. And we've also used updated household intentions to transact data, mortgage stress, and affordability metrics from our surveys. And in passing, it's worth noting that the ANZ revealed their mortgage underwriting standards are now around 20% tighter, though they are focusing more on investor lending ahead. Other banks are even tighter. Still, mortgage power has been significantly curtailed. And here is a summary of the scenarios. First, business as usual, which is basically driven off the current RBA economic scenario. Secondly, things can only get better. Here, the economy is weaker as wages continue to grow only slowly. Costs of living rise, and the RBA cuts later in the year. There'll be some government tax stimulation, either before or after the election, or both. And there'll be some easing of credit rules, so lending growth accelerates a little. The third scenario, not yet doomsday, is a locally driven downturn, as wages are flat despite some mortgage rate repricing. The RBA cuts significantly, unemployment rises, and one bank requires assistance. Fiscal stimulus does not have significant impact as household consumption falls. The fourth scenario, I've called Ireland 2.0, it's an international crisis overlaid on scenario two, with QE and lower rates in response. It may be from Europe, say Brexit, it may be from China, or from the US or some combination as global growth continues to fall. And in response, cash rates are cut hard to zero bounds. QE in Australia commences, and banks are rescued and restructured via bail-in and bail-out. And scenario five, which I've called Iceland 2.0, is as above, but here, no bank rescues are executed, so banks fail. The RBA moves to negative interest rates, like Japan. And you can watch a full recording of our live event and the question and answers that went with it. The AFR this week carried a story suggesting that overvaluation of properties was widespread and were partly driven by real estate agents trying to generate more revenue through advertising campaigns paid for by the vendor, which then generates commissions and other incentives from advertising companies. The higher the forecast price of a property, the more is likely to be spent on advertising. A lot of agents are losing money. The kickbacks help keep their businesses running. Now, this is something which our property insider, Edwin Almeida, recently highlighted. Look at our post, Breaking with Tradition. And I was quoted in that article. Quote, Martin North, principal of Digital Finance Analytics, an independent consultancy, said discounts of more than 40% were also being made in Victoria's Red Hill, a leafy weekend retreat about 82 kilometres southeast of Melbourne, and Sydney suburbs including Box Hill and Agnes Banks. Typically, in a downturn, it's the top end of the market which dies first, and the decay in price spreads down the market like a canker. He estimated 1 in 10 households were in negative equity, where the value of the mortgage is bigger than the expected realizable value of the property. And the AFR went on to say that the falls are outpacing predictions by major lenders such as Gareth Edge, senior economist for Commonwealth Bank of Australia, the nation's largest lender. Mr. Eyre said property prices will this year fall by about 5% in Sydney and 6% in Melbourne. That would take the fall in Sydney prices from their July 2017 peak to around 15% and 13% in Melbourne. And Mr. Eyre expects the national peak to trough falls to be about 12%. Well, good luck with that. LF Economics, on the other hand, released a report which we discussed in our post-crisis. What crisis? The latest on home prices, and is much more realistic, I think, saying a bloodbath is possible with falls this year in Melbourne and Sydney before allowing for inflation of between 15 and 20%. And this could rise to 25% if the finance and housing markets continue to deteriorate. I discussed this on Seven Sunrise and left Koshy all but speechless. It's worth watching the video just for that. And there was more evidence of the rising delinquencies in Australia. With the S&P ratings release to December 2018 out, showing that defaults overall rose in all states other than in Tasmania. And significantly, the 90-day plus arrears rates are rising as predicted by our mortgage stress analysis as the slow roasting of mortgage borrowers continues. The plus 90-day default rates were up amongst the major banks and also the regional banks. And the longer-term delinquencies are the ones that are going to bite down the track. And just a quick word on the China coal conundrum. Nobody really knows whether there is something official going on or whether it's just a little local difficulty. But the more this goes on, the more it seems to me that it's likely to be more than just a local misunderstanding. Maybe China is deliberately slowing imports of coal to protect their local market. Or maybe it has something to do with the relationship between China and Australia. But whichever way you look at it, it's likely that we will see coal exports slide from their highs. And of course, coal is our number one export and China is our number one customer. So this could be another trigger to a potential financial disaster later. And the IMF reported on Australia this week. Directors noted that although growth is expected to remain above trend in the near term, a weaker economic environment, high household debt and vulnerabilities in the housing sector could weigh on medium-term growth. Against this background, they highlighted the importance of maintaining supportive macroeconomic policies to secure strong demand momentum, address macro-financial risks and boost long-term productivity and potential growth. Directors welcome the authorities' macroprudential interventions to reduce credit risk and reinforce sound lending standards. They concurred that with high prices for residential real estate, along with elevated household debt, macroprudential policies should hold the course on the improved lending standards and further strengthen bank resilience by refining the capital adequacy frameworks. Directors also saw merit in expanding and strengthening the macroprudential toolkit to allow for more flexible responses to financial stability risks. And directors underscored the need to remain vigilant about housing market developments. They noted that while the housing market correction is helping housing affordability, continued housing supply reforms remain critical for broad affordability and to reduce macro-financial vulnerabilities. And directors generally encouraged the authorities to explore where possible alternative and effective non-discriminatory measures for buyers. Or in other words, find ways to keep the housing bubble alive despite the risks. And I see the hand of Treasury here. Also, it's worth noting that the output gap and fiscal balance for Australia is considerably worse than New Zealand, with Australian net debt at 15%, worse than New Zealand, though better than Canada or the UK. And New Zealand has generally had counter-cyclical fiscal policy, and this is reflected in the evolution of its net debt to GDP ratio. Australia is not dealing with either private debt or international debt, though there is a little more attention on public debt, but this does not bode well. All this is in the context of rising global debt, which has reached yet another new record, and we need to be concerned about that. And here is the killer slide. The question to ask is, why did prices take off around the year 2000? The answer is stupid tax policy. As Peter Costello halved the capital gains tax on property and with negative gearing led to a plain stupid rise as investors crowded into the market. Of course, the reverse will also be true as investors are already deserting the field and Labour, if they win and trims the tax breaks to get back to a more normal housing market level, will just continue that trajectory. Despite the pain, that would actually be a good thing. But we still must deal with the legacy of debt. The words I quoted before from the Bank of England are ringing in my ears. And we've argued that the Royal Commission into Financial Services misconduct passed on the main reform area structural separation. As Paul Keating, the architect of financial deregulation in the 1980s, said in The Australian recently, the Royal Commissioner should have recommended this conflict between product and advice be prohibited. This he monumentally failed to do. He should have acted upon the examination and the evidence of these serious conflicts of interest. But the separation torch has been picked up and is in the Senate, and there is now a 3-month inquiry. This is a golden opportunity to push hard on getting a better structure for the finance sector. And I'll discuss this with the CEC's Robbie Barwick. See another swipe. There is a chance now to make a submission to the Senate inquiry, and I encourage you to do this via the online submission process. And to assist, I'll be releasing a video in a few days with some key points and how-to guides. We can really make a difference. On another issue, broker remuneration continues to flare as the industry attempts to push back on the idea of replacing broker commissions with a fee paid for by prospective borrowers. Now both sides of politics have gone coy on this, citing competition-related issues. And this week, Labour came out with the idea of a scaled fee of 1.1% being paid for by the banks for mortgage applications to mortgage brokers. Now, that misses the point because it still means a bigger loan translates to a bigger payment to a broker, so the conflict of interest would still exist. Perhaps the best option would be a flat fee paid by the bank, as, after all, the bank is outsourcing an element of its loan processing to the broker, and that's irrespective of the size of the loan. I think Labour has lost the plot here, but at least they are still supporting best interests and the removal of trail commissions. And finally, home prices fell again according to CoreLogic, taking the fall from peak to trough in Sydney to 13% and in Melbourne to 9.5% and in Perth to 17.4%. And auction clearance rates were still slightly higher than before Christmas at 51.2% on 1,259 auctions, well down on last year. Sydney ended at 54.6% and Melbourne at 52.5%, and I continue to see accelerated weakness in Melbourne. Nothing here signals a sign of a bounce, despite the spruikers. As McGrath put it in their results release, economic factors are contributing to a significant reduction in transaction volumes, with settled sales for the real estate sector nationally down 13.2%, and across the eastern seaboard, Sydney is down 20.3%, and Melbourne down 22.3%, and Brisbane down 11.3% on the 12 months to January 2019. And this is shown in their share price, which is down 36.9%. And from there, we can look more broadly at the rest of the local markets. The S&P ASX 100 rose 0.41% on Friday to end at 5,077 and is 3.78% higher than a year ago. The S&P ASX 200 Volatility Index, or Fear Index, was down again. It dropped 6.97% on Friday to end at 1131 and is down 17.21% from a year ago. The S&P ASX 200 Financials was up 0.54% to 5,950 and is still down 6.06% from a year ago. ANZ was up 0.65% to 27.95 and is down just a little from 12 months back. The Commonwealth Bank was up 1.03% on Friday to 73.85 and is down 1.28% from a year ago. National Australia Bank was down 0.08% to 24.69 and it's down 15.3%, partly on the announcement this week of the significant payout that the exiting CEO is to receive. And also Fitch Ratings this week downgraded the outlook on National Australia Bank debt, and they did the same for their Bank of New Zealand subsidiary in New Zealand. Westpac was flat at 26.77 and is 10.72% lower than a year ago. And Westpac's share price was not helped by the fact that Maurice Blackburn has now commenced a class action against them with regard to more than 10,000 mortgages, which they claim are outside responsible lending conditions. And this, of course, relates to the household expenditure measure question at Westpac. And I don't think this is going to be the last claim for poor lending practice that we're going to see against the major banks, partly as a result of the recent Royal Commission findings. The Bank of Queensland was up 0.45% to $8.89, but is 27.73% down from last year. Suncorp was up 1.08% to $13.16 and is just a little below where it was 12 months ago. Bendigo and Adelaide Bank was up 1.33% to $9.92 and is down 11.41% from 12 months ago. And the AMP is sitting at 2.35, down 0.42% on Friday, but down 55.64% from a year ago, so the Hayne effect is alive and well. Macquarie was down 0.26% to 127.64, but has performed very well. It's up 24.47% over the last 12 months, with more encouraging news expected ahead. And Genworth, the lender's mortgage insurer, was down 1.56% to 252 and is down more than 5% from a year ago. And of course, we have to expect higher loss claims in the months ahead. Mortgage Choice is up 12.42% to 86 cents, but down 68% from a year ago. Their presentation this week of their results really was focusing on the future of mortgage brokers and their attempts to try and lobby the politicians to change the outcomes of the Royal Commission. The Aussie US dollar rose 0.04% on Friday to 71.30 and is down 9.14% from a year ago. And it moved down quite a bit when the China coal holdup was announced, but has recovered a little since then. The cross gold Aussie dollar was down 0.2% to end at 1,863 and is down 10.08% from a year ago. And the Bitcoin cross Australian dollar was down 1.20% to end at 4,968 and is down a massive 62.91% from last year. Now, across the US. And over the past year in the US markets, the S&P 500 posted its highest closing level since November the 8th on Friday, as investors clung to signs of progress on the ongoing trade talks between the United States and China. Investors assessed a slew of headlines on the talks, with top trade negotiators from the two countries meeting to wrap up a week of discussions on some of the thorniest issues in their trade war. If the two sides fail to reach a deal by midnight on March the 1st, then their seven-month trade war could escalate. Optimism on the trade front and dovish signals from the US Federal Reserve have driven the recent gains and left indices well above their lows of December, when the market swooned on fears of an economic slowdown. And US President Donald Trump was reportedly set to meet with China's top trade negotiator, Chinese Vice Premier Liu He, as the world's two largest economies scramble to reach a trade deal before the US increases tariffs on around $200 billion in Chinese imports on the 1st of March. Markets have been closely following the standoff between China and the US amid concerns of the negative impact on the global economy, and the meeting between Trump and Liu is taken as a sign of progress in reaching a deal. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 0.7% to 26,031 and is up 4.25% from a year ago. The S&P 100 was up 0.63% to 1,225 and is 1.93% higher than a year ago. The S&P 500 was up 0.64% to 2,793 and is up 2.72% from this time last year. The S&P 500 is now up about 19% since its late December low. The S&P 500 Technology Index was up 1.3%, leading gains among the 11 major S&P sectors, while the trade-exposed industrials index climbed 0.6%. All three indices registered gains for the week, with both the Dow and the Nasdaq posting a ninth week of increases. The volatility index was down again, a further 9.39% fall on Friday to 1351, and that's down 27.77% from a year ago. So we're back down into the calm areas, thanks, I think, to the latest news on the trade talks. The S&P 500 financials index was down 0.55% to 425.53 and is 11.2% down from 12 months ago. And Goldman Sachs is down 0.18% to 196 and is down 25.45% from last year. The Nasdaq Composite was up 0.91% to 7,527 and is up 3.35% from a year ago. Apple was up 1.1% to 172.95 and is flat where it was this time last year. Google Alphabet was up 1.12% to 1,116 and is down 0.86% from this time last year. Amazon was up 0.75% to 1,631 and is 9.21% higher than 12 months ago. Facebook was up 1.16% to 161.89 and is down 10.04% from 12 months back. Intel was up 2.10% to 52.49 and is 11.91% higher than 12 months ago. The United States' 10-year bond is down 0.05% to 2.65, whilst the three-month bond rate is up 0.09% to 2.45. The US dollar index was at 96.49, down 0.12%, and is 7.32% higher than a year ago. The British pound US dollar rate was up 0.02% to 1.3055 and is down 6.35% from a year ago, as the Brexit talks continue to grind on. The FTSE was up 0.16% to 7,178 and is down 1.57% compared with a year ago. The FTSE Financial Services Index was up 0.18% to 656 and is down 2.99% from 12 months back. The Royal Bank of Scotland was up 0.35% to 256.10 and is 8% lower than this time last year. the euro-US dollar rate was up 0.02% to 1.1344 and is down 7.72% over the last 12 months. And European Trade Commissioner Cecilia Malmström said on Friday that a transatlantic trade deal could be achieved before the end of the year, as the economic bloc hopes to avoid the threat of US automotive tariffs. The US and Europe ended a standoff of several months last July when Trump agreed to hold off on car tariffs while the two sides looked to improve trade ties. Deutsche Bank was down 0.56% to 7.69 and is 43.44% lower than 12 months ago. The Chinese yuan US dollar rate was up 0.08% on Friday to 0.1489 and is down 5.65% over the last 12 months. Crude oil futures were up 0.23% to 57.09, and that's down 7.77% on 12 months ago. And oil prices headed higher on Friday, on track for a second consecutive weekly rise as progress in the US-China trade talks adjusted expectations for global demand higher in the hope of a deal. Evidence that trade tensions between the world's two largest economies may be thawing, together with OPEC-led production cuts, have translated into a rally of more than 20% this year, though concerns remain over surging US production. The Energy Information Administration reported on Thursday that weekly production stateside hit a record high of 12 million barrels per day. Gold futures were up 0.21% to 1,330, and that's down 2.91% from 12 months back. Silver futures were up 0.50% to 1588, and is down 5% from 12 months back. The copper futures was up 1.83% to 295, and that's down 9.81% from the last 12 months. And the Bitcoin US dollar rate is up 1.7% to 4,060.8, but still down 61.55, showing a slight recovery, but still a long way from its recent highs. So the housing sector continues to look weak, and credit remains tight. And the financial crisis is, well, so close now you can almost smell it. In fact, you can get a nice overview at Nuggets News. I provided several comments to that show alongside Roger Montgomery, entitled Australia, a Coming Financial Crisis. I'll put a link in the comments below. And here is a flavour of what I said.
Yeah, so here's the thing, right? The 2.7 trillion in the superannuation section, of course, most people are forced to save into it, is looking for a home. So that amount of money has to go somewhere. Some of it goes offshore, but a lot of it is invested locally by the fund managers here. And a lot of it flows back into both the property sector and the finance sector specifically. So what people may not understand is that the superannuation sector here is actually highly leveraged into property and into the finance sector. And if either of those went south, as perhaps is possible now, that could have a direct impact on the superannuation sector, could mean that the value will go down. And the other side of it is that the superannuation sector has been one of the forces that's been inflating property prices. With regard to negative gearing, again, I think that mistake was made some years ago. And what it's done is essentially given people with property, and particularly multiple investment properties, the opportunity to pay for those through taxpayer rebates. So in other words, the broader taxpayer community is helping those property investors outbid and outlast most other types of property purchases. So it has distorted the market. It doesn't actually lead to the right outcomes, and I think it should be removed. Yeah, so unfortunately, we've had a generation of bad lending, and many people got loans that they should never have got. The Royal Commission showed that over the last 12 months. And now the chickens are coming home to roost, partly because incomes are flat, cost of living are rising, people have got very large mortgages, and of course we've seen some interest rate rises relatively recently. So my research says more than a million households are now in mortgage stress and have cash flow issues relating to their mortgage repayments on an annual, on a monthly basis. And it's also worth saying that the rate of increase in mortgage stress is accelerating. And that's simply because incomes have been flat for so long and people are highly leveraged into the sector. So what that basically takes us to is that we have a large number of households who are actually in difficulty at a time when home prices are now falling. And so as well as mortgage stress, I also look at negative equity. In other words, your mortgage is worth more than the value of your property. And now we're seeing more households caught with that downward force too. So you put those two things together and the outlook looks pretty wobbly ahead. Well, obviously, many people will actually say migration is the way to solve the problem, because if you bring more people into the country, you can give them jobs and they can generate more economic activity in the country. And by the way, they can perhaps mop up some of the spare capacity in terms of all that new construction that's going on at the moment, the 200,000 units coming on a year. The problem we've got is that, in fact, migration just puts more pressure on our infrastructure. It doesn't necessarily solve our problem. And if you look at, for example, GDP per capita, which takes out of the equation the growth, it looks a lot worse than the GDP overall number. So my view is that migration is actually a false signal in terms of creating the right outcomes that we need. And I think we should actually be much more careful in terms of the way we manage the growth in our economy, because just being bigger with more people isn't necessarily going to solve our economic issues. Yes. So in fact, if you go back and look, there were a number of reports written around the time warning about the risks in the finance system, and specifically related to the way that mortgage lending was working and other things too. But that report was rather conveniently buried. And of course, for a number of years, the Reserve Bank basically used the household sector and their ability to consume more thanks to bigger credit availability and bigger mortgages to stoke the economy as the mining boom went away. The trouble is now we've created ourselves one huge issue. And frankly, we're now in the situation where the amount of debt in the system is so high that it's unlikely that it will be repaid in an orderly fashion. And that then creates significant broader economic risks over the next 10 years or so.
Andex did a great job in putting this all together. So do go and subscribe over at his YouTube channel. As always, if you like what you've seen here today, please share and like the posts and add a comment or question. I read them all. And if you want to join the growing band of subscribers who receive alerts when we release new posts, do subscribe now by hitting the subscribe bell. And if you've already subscribed, many thanks. I really appreciate your support and participation. I'm Martin North, the Principal Analyst at Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time.